Welcome to Bioethics On Air, the program that brings you thoughtful, in-depth commentary on ethics at the crossroads of science, medicine, and daily life. I'm Joe Zalot, your host. We are a broadcast of the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia. Before introducing our topic and guest today, I would ask that if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support them, as well as support the mission and ongoing work of the NCBC, to please go to our website, ncbcenter.org, and click on the red donate button. We thank you in advance for your generosity. You may have noticed that, with the exception of one episode from January of 2024, Bioethics On Air has been on hiatus for the past 9 months or so. The reason for this is that back in August of 2023, yours truly became the NCBC Director of Education. And since that time, I've been focused on updating our NCBC certification program curriculum and moving it to a fully online format. For information on our newly revised National Catholic Certification Program in Healthcare Ethics and to register for our next course, which begins in August of 2024, please go again to ncbcenter.org, hover on the Education tab, and click on Certification Program. I'm happy to report that the updating process is complete, and I am very much looking forward to recording new Bioethics On Air episodes on a regular basis. So, a lot has happened in the world of healthcare since the fall of 2023. So, in this podcast, I'd like to update listeners on a number of the important issues and challenges that we face today. And I should note that we are recording this interview on May 2nd of 2024. Now, I can't think of a better person to offer this update than Dr. Tim Millay. Tim is a retired orthopedic surgeon, and maybe more importantly, at least for our purposes here, he is the chair of the Catholic Medical Association's Healthcare Policy Committee. In his role with this committee, Tim works with CMA members to address healthcare-related issues through both expert testimony and education, and he also works with state Catholic conferences and other Catholic healthcare leaders to address these issues on both the state and national levels. I should also mention that the goal of our conversation today is not to resolve, so to speak, the various topics we're going to discuss, but to offer listeners an update on where we stand on these issues and what we might do moving forward. Dr. Tim Millay, sorry for the very long introduction, but welcome to Bioethics On Air.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to talk with you again, and congratulations on finishing the curriculum revamp.
Oh my goodness, it has been a 9 month slog. A lot of work, but a lot of good stuff. Our first academic year class went through, and the reviews are very, very good. So I'm very happy about that.
Terrific! Congratulations.
Yeah. Now we'll have to get you into the program.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about time constraints. We can do
that. Well, Tim, you are a brand new guest on our podcast and one of those people who I've been trying to get for a while. But as a new guest, can you tell our listeners a bit about your background, specifically your education and your work experience?
Well, of course. I'm in Iowa now after coming home some years ago from some traveling around the country. I was raised in small town Iowa, which is essentially Iowa's just one big town with small suburbs just south of the border with Minnesota, and went on to college, finished in as a physical therapy school graduate at Washington University in St. Louis. And I'm not a rocket scientist, but what I discovered was that the farther south you go, the winters get easier. So as a single young man looking for his first job out of college, I decided to interview all along the Gulf Coast and from Corpus Christi all the way over to Naples, ultimately ended up taking a job at a Catholic hospital in Mobile, Alabama, which was a terrific decision. I married my favorite coworker about a little over a year after that. We met my first day of work, and it was she's been lifting me up ever since then. And after working as a PT for about 4 years, I went to medical school at University of South Alabama in Mobile. So just no move required. We were married. We had our first child, and our second was born in medical school. Three more during my residency and fellowship at Southern Illinois University in Springfield, Illinois. When we finished there, we moved to Davenport, Iowa, the Quad Cities area, Davenport, Bettendorf in Iowa, Rock Island, Moline in Illinois, just across the river from us. We moved in 1992. Another great decision to move. And blessed to practice for about 30 years, recently retired. My greatest gratitude in the practice here, it's not a small area metropolitan-wise, but it's not huge. And I tell new doctors when they'd come into town, you're very lucky to be here because your friends will become your patients and your patients will become your friends. And just before we started recording here, I'd stopped by the grocery store, and that's where I make rounds now. I run into people that I don't remember their names. They remember me. And it really is very affirming. And, every surgeon needs their ego inflated a little bit. So if I'm down on myself, I go to the grocery store and they make me feel better. So, but we're, married with 5 kids and now we're on to 16, expecting grandchild number 16, this summer. So it has been a terrific run and it continues to be a terrific run.
Sounds good. How about podcast rounds? I know I've told you about my pickleball shoulder and I'm still waiting for you to fix it for me.
I have to admit, now that you mentioned that, with other podcasts and interviews I've done, if maybe not during the recording, but afterwards, hey, could you hang on for just a minute? I got a question for you.
And
I did, my practice was predominantly, really exclusively spine surgery. And who doesn't have a back problem every once in a while? So there's significant job security. And apparently when you retire, they think you're still an expert, but I try to stay up, but not like I did when I was actively practicing.
Yeah, that's great. And Tim, we've known each other for a few years now. I just have to tell the audience, one of the funniest things I ever heard on a podcast, you did a podcast with Dr. Doctor, and the focus of it was how to do your fantasy football team based on injury reports. I thought that was hysterical. I loved it. It was a great way to use your background for something that's just so completely practical.
And so far, I haven't been, sued for fiduciary malpractice. I don't know if anybody lost money on my advice with that. But I made it clear during the podcast that I no longer dabbled in fantasy football because I was not good at it. But, the injury factor, sure, that comes in.
I love it. All right. So, Tim, you're retired now. What's in addition to the CMA healthcare policy team, policy committee, I should say, and we're going to talk about that, but what's occupying your time in your retirement?
It really comes, there are two main categories and a secondary category and another level category, a little lesser importance. I mentioned 16 grandchildren, 5 kids and their families are all around the country. And that takes a significant amount of time. We're very blessed that my mother, who's 91, and my in-laws, who are 95 and 91, are still with us and alert and just remarkable people. So we're in that sandwich phase, where we're dealing with the younger generation and the older generation. And we're just blessed with the days we have with all of them. So we're on the road a fair amount. My wife and I call it dashboard dating. We spend a lot of time. That's where we catch up on things and audiobooks and things like that. So that takes a significant amount of our time. The CMA stuff, if you were interviewing my wife, she would say, well, how much time does he spend with CMA? And her eyes would roll. She wouldn't say too much, but she'd be thinking it. And she's right. I have thoroughly enjoyed the increased ability to interact with the CMA and with the members. I encountered the CMA, my first conference with the CMA was in 2012, 14 or 12 years ago. And I knew nothing about it. I just needed some continuing education credits. That weekend, I was going to go in, get a cup of coffee, listen to George Weigel's talk and take off. I didn't. I stayed the entire day, stayed the next 2 days. I have not missed a day of the annual conference since that time. And it got me through my last several years in practice, keeping my sanity. Mm-hmm. And I owe the organization this time commitment as well. It's good people that become lifelong friends, and it is one of the most faith-affirming endeavors anybody, well, healthcare or outside of healthcare, getting involved in organizations like that really makes that faith life real and personal and powerful. And yeah. I would recommend anybody listening to this that is not familiar with the CMA to check it out and consider joining.
Yeah. So CMA, again, the Catholic Medical Association. And Tim, I would second you on that. And this may turn into a bit of a commercial for the Catholic Medical Association too. But we at the NCBC, we have a table, and we're exhibitors at the CMA conference, and I've been down there since 2017. And I guess I would describe it as a big group hug, in the sense of like-minded people who are out in the world, dealing with all sorts of challenges, but they come together, you know, people sharing their faith, and it's really a time for just, you know, to be together and to be reinvigorated in your faith and in your practice. So it really is a one, and I'm not a medical doctor, but you can absolutely see it there. So anyway, Tim, tell us a little bit about, we've talked a bit about the Catholic Medical Association, but in particular, the Healthcare Policy Committee. So how did you get involved with this committee, and what is the work that you do for it?
Well, how I got involved and became, I was on the committee for several years, and my good friend and really my mentor, Steve White, who's a past president mm-hmm. of CMA, Steve not only had been chair of the Healthcare Policy Committee for approximately 20 years, Steve started the Healthcare Policy Committee. And for some reason, in a moment of poor insight, Steve asked me to take over the chair because he wanted to move on to some other endeavors. And I won't say that I was dragged kicking and screaming into it, but I was very, very hesitant. Those were really big shoes to fill. And what do I know? I mean, I'm a surgeon. I spent 30, well, including my training, up to almost 40 years kind of working like a dictator. I mean, this is what we're doing, and we're doing it now. And now I have to do a 180 and become a political personality. I have to be able to listen to both sides of an argument. What I say doesn't necessarily go. But after a lot of prayer and encouragement from Steve and several others within the CMA, I took over the chair, and I believe it was early 2021, I think, that I became chair of the committee. And the task of the Healthcare Policy Committee, we are to monitor the social and cultural and political aspects in our society and how they impact in healthcare in general, but specifically on Catholic healthcare. And when I accepted the chair of the committee, it was before the election in November of 2020, and assumed the chair in January of 21. And that's when everything started to happen. Yep. My first, even today, we're coping better with it, but getting peppered with these issues. Yep. On a regular and frequent basis.
And we're going to be talking about some of those issues in this interview today. Yeah.
And it used to be that we'd have to deal with it pretty much only at a federal level. But since the Dobbs decision and the striking down of Roe v. Wade, well, now we've got 50 little test tubes out there that we're trying to work in each state-based experiment. So the playing field has gotten bigger. The issues have gotten more varied and more contentious, but I keep reminding myself there's a reason we're here and doing this at this time. That's what we were put here for.
Yeah, absolutely. Tim, can you tell us about some of the individuals or groups that you interact with through your work with the CMA's Healthcare Policy Committee?
That is one of the greatest blessings of being in this role. It is a learning curve that is slow and long for me. We have what I call a deep pool of alphabet soup organizations. I mean, we have so many, a lot of them, well, NCBC, certainly. the bishops at the USCCB and their staff, the National Association of Catholic Nurses were involved with, Christ Medicus Foundation, others like that. But then there are medical organizations that are very, very like-minded and not explicitly religious-based. The pro-life OBGYNs with APLOG, the American College of Pediatricians, ACPEDS, that's been at the forefront of the gender issue debate. And we've really formed an increasingly tight relationship with some other religious denominations involved in medical care, the Christian Medical and Dental Association, CMDA, and recently formed the American Jewish Medical Association, which is Orthodox Jewish physicians that really they formed. I started talking with the rabbi that leads the Coalition for Jewish Values, which is their parent organization, oh gosh, 2 or 3 years ago, ultimately wanting to help them build this organization. And after October 7th, that organization has exploded in membership for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
An umbrella organization that CMA is part of, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, and I believe we'll talk about that.
We will.
Later, yeah. and we also have to tap into non-medical organizations that do things that doctors they're not trained to do, we don't know what to do, we don't want to do it sometimes. And those are commonly the legal advocacy groups, Alliance Defending Freedom, Thomas More Society, Beckett, and think tanks as well, Ethics and Public Policy Center, Heritage, Religious Freedom Institute, those entities, and having them shoulder to shoulder or really in front telling us what to do, that has been a tremendous benefit for us, doing things and guiding and coaching us in areas that we are not familiar with.
Very good. All right. So Tim, let's get into some topics here. Let's start off with the abortion question, because that's probably the most contentious and probably the one that most people are aware of. So this coming November, at least 11 states will have ballot questions seeking to enshrine the so-called right to abortion in their state constitutions, or to otherwise expand abortion. And I should let listeners know that I'm including a link to the Human Life Action website that has details about these various ballot initiatives. But Tim, what do listeners need to know about the abortion industry's efforts, and what is the Catholic Medical Association doing to combat them?
Yeah, this is the leading example of the state-by-state issues that we are having to address since the Dobbs decision. And yes, we have those that website with Human Life Action. That is very helpful. If anyone is in the states that are listed, there are 11 states listed on that website, click on that and find out what's going on in your state and what you can do to help with it. So far, out of the 11 states that are in question, we know that three of them, Florida, Maryland, New York, have a ballot initiative that's going to be on the ballot. The other eight most of them are likely to be on the ballot once the petitions are completed and approved and validated. Interestingly, for example, like in Arkansas, there are competing petitions. There's one to say we want a ballot initiative that puts the right to abortion in the Constitution as an amendment, and another, an opposing one that says, no, we're going to have an amendment that says abortion is not a right. So there is that coming up. The shift from legislative-based arguing to ballot initiatives has been quite interesting, and it seems quite apparent that the abortion industry has identified their success in states like Kansas and Ohio, and Michigan as well, exactly. So, you know, that which gets rewarded gets repeated. So they've kind of figured this out, and strategically taking that debate out of away from the legislators and taking it to the public. You can have a deep red state where there's a Republican majority, a wide Republican majority, but the percentage of legislators that support abortion may be very small, but at the public, they're going to play that game. They're going to go to the public and try to play on the public's interpretation of what they're told by the pro-abortion faction. And it is a more expensive and work-intensive way to go about this for both sides of the argument, but we don't tend to have the deep pockets. The pro-abortion lobby has the deeper pockets with this. So what can the CMA do? Well, what can we all do that are pro-life? If we don't have the money, we could still outwork them. And that's what we really have to do is to put in the time and the effort and really unify. I mentioned all those different organizations. Where we see successes in various ethical debates in medicine, state by state or federal, it's when everybody within under that umbrella starts rowing the boat in the same direction. The messaging is critical with this. If you analyze how the amendments were approved in other states, Kansas, Ohio, Michigan, the information provided by the proponents of those amendments is very, I mean, to say it, to be charitable, it's shallow, it's not detailed, but it really is more misguidance. It's not the full picture.
And if you I'll say it, Tim, because I've heard people in those states, they say that the abortion industry is deliberately speaking untruths. What they are saying and what they're putting on their commercials is not true.
Correct.
And I'll say it.
No, I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, I try to be as charitable as I can, you know, ultimately, the fact of the situation is that when you are given misleading information, when you are told false statements are made, they've got to be pointed out. And, you know, we've got to start raising that question about, ask the proponents, what about a 30-week pregnancy abortion? What about a full term? What about partial birth abortions? When does life begin? How do you define health of the mother? Is it she might have a problem 6 months from now because of this? Is it a mental health issue? And really getting into the specifics of that, they wrap up this tragic process in warm and fuzzy language. And reproductive rights. Well, you have a pregnancy; reproduction has already occurred, and you can't, you know, the protection. And you don't hear these arguments from the opposition side. The baby is not mentioned. It's focusing on the woman with that. So, you know, one of my buzz phrase that. I'm sure some people get sick of, but I've said it before and I'll say it again, silence is surrender. And it's not just the medical side that has to be involved with this. This is an all hands on deck time in abortion issues and all of the other issues that come into play. And if we remain quiet, you know, we essentially are waving a white flag and saying, yeah, whatever, go ahead. Parents don't do that with their kids. Bosses don't do that with their employees. Our politicians should not be doing that with their decisions, and we should not allow that to be the case. We've got to speak up and be more and more engaged.
Yeah. Tim, we could talk about this all day, but just one follow-up question on this. From your perspective, what impact do the efforts of the abortion industry to expand abortion What impact do they have on Catholic healthcare, particularly on states? I'm thinking of, as you mentioned, Kansas, we talked about Ohio, we talked about Michigan, where these ballot referendum have been, or abortion and other things, by the way, it's not just abortion, are being voted into the Constitution by people of those states. What impact does this have on Catholic healthcare?
Oh, potentially catastrophic. I mean, the interest in the rejuvenation of truly Catholic healthcare. You know, what we remember from 40, 50 years ago, if you went to a Catholic hospital, you knew what their values were, and that's why you went there. And we see a resurgence in the interest in that. However, if these types of ballot initiatives, these amendments are adopted, well, then the question becomes, okay, so now abortion is a right. What about the Catholic hospitals, the Catholic clinicians that refuse to do it? And conscience rights is the next big issue that is kind of the overarching theme for all of these issues. And the combination of protection of conscience rights and protection of religious freedom for the facilities, the institutions, the hospitals, the health systems, all the way down to the employees of those systems. If it comes to a point where we either have to participate in these unethical interventions or lose our jobs, that's the death knell for Catholic healthcare. And, you know, it's not a veiled threat from the other side.
No, not at all.
They want to see Catholic hospitals go away. And we have to man the ramparts here. We have to just strengthen that opposition to them and point out the errors and the fallacies of what they're saying. They're taking away our protected constitutional rights so that after they've put another right in their constitution. So this is not a tit for tat. It's either right or it's wrong. And we have to stand up and say that loudly and clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to ask you, Tim, a kind of controversial question, but it's got to be asked. And I'm wondering, can you speak about the Democrat parties, and in particular, Joe Biden, who, as we all know, portrays himself to be a Catholic and a faithful Catholic. Can you speak about the Democratic Party, Joe Biden's all in, so to speak, on abortion? I mean, what does this mean for Catholics who are registered Democrats? And what does it mean for the future of our country that we have a political party that is just so all in on abortion and other things? I mean, it's not just abortion. But, you know, and even the fact that you, at least on the national level, I think it's almost impossible to be a Democrat and be pro-life. Like, what does this mean for us?
It really is. It's sad to me. I was raised a JFK Democrat. Mm-hmm. And my dad gave me flack after I got out of college when he realized I'd voted for Reagan. And why'd you do that? I said, well, Dad, I started paying taxes. And we all know that if JFK ran now, he'd be to the right of center, even in the Republican Party. Yeah. So the usual complaint is I didn't leave the party. The party left me. And my youngest brother is an attorney. And I was complaining to him about all the politics and how much it aggravates me. And he said, oh, yeah, what are you complaining about? I'm a pro-life Democrat. Yeah, you're right. I do have it a little easier. And Joe Biden is representative. You know, Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and so many of those, Dick Durbin are. Yep. It just makes my anger go up so much when I hear the words devout Catholic and pro-abortion in the same sentence. Those are absolutely incompatible. The church has been clear on that, unwavering and consistent for decades.
Right.
So that's a disconnect that needs to be highlighted as much as possible. And the pro-life Catholic Democrats, God bless them. I mean, they are, you know, they're left with a decision. Either they leave the party or they try to work to change it from the inside. And that's a heavy lift. Right. I was in Washington for the Supreme Court trial with the Mifepristone case. And one of the speakers was from Democrats for Life at the rally on mm-hmm. the steps. And just absolutely marvelous group of people that do that. And so they're clearly not single issue voters.
Right.
You know, you cannot be a pro-life Democrat as a single issue voter. If there's an upside to what the Democratic Party is doing, and I'm looking at this from a political calculus, mm-hmm. personal opinion, I think they've gotten too far out over their skis over the past three and a half years, this relentless push, progressive push on abortion and transgender interventions and assisted suicide and conscience rights, religious freedom, intimidations, accompany that with declines in overall trust in institutions, coming out of COVID, particularly the economic decline that we've had, the international affairs that we're having to deal with. I think they have pushed too much too soon, too much too quickly. And God willing, there's a backlash and a correction. I think in November, I think the pendulum, I think, will swing back again. And you can read a lot of pundits who talk about 50-year cycles and 200-year cycles and things like that. Well, you know, humans are not cicadas. You know, we don't go away for a length of time and then come back. But we can come back and make a lot of noise. And the problem is, if abortion, say, for example, if abortion is fully entrenched, it is established, it is constitutionally protected in each state, that's a mistake that is going to be very difficult to correct, to undo that error. And that's why right now, I don't think we cannot just assume that the election in November is going to stop this runaway train. You know, we've got to hit the brakes now, and we got to keep our foot on the brake even if a successful outcome in November, where we all can breathe a little easier, we're still there. The proponents of these unethical interventions and philosophies, they're not going to go away. I mean, I'll say literally give the devil his due.
Right.
They are really good and really relentless and very strategic in what they do. And we cannot let our guard down.
Yeah. All right. Let's change topics again. We could, I'm holding back because we could talk about these issues for hours, but little good news, but then who knows what happens to it. So earlier this year, the Alabama State Supreme Court ruled that frozen IVF embryos are human beings under the law. Good decision. Very good decision. Correct decision. However, this decision has set off a firestorm of criticism and whatever else, and it has led to states, including Alabama, passing legislation to so-called protect access to in vitro fertilization. Tim, what's at stake in this issue, and what do our listeners need to know about it?
You know, first a side note, I lived in Alabama for 8 years. Some of my best friends from medical school are still in Alabama. I'm one of the few that crossed the Mason-Dixon line and became a bad Yankee again. But when I heard about this decision, and it was a bolt from the blue, I mean, I didn't see this coming. The clinic where this all started in Mobile, I'm familiar with the people that work there. And an 8-1 decision by the Alabama Supreme Court. Nobody should be surprised. That's a very, very conservative state and a devoutly religious state, particularly. But what it points out to me in the big picture is the Catholic Church, in regards to IVF and all the ARTs, the assisted reproductive technologies, we are now a 21st century John the Baptist. We are the voice in the wilderness among religious denominations. I cannot find any other denomination other than Catholicism that is opposed to these technologies. There are some that will say, well, it's not ideal, but we understand and we can allow it sometimes. But even if you look back before this was even happening, before Baby Louise in the UK and the first case here in 1981 in the States, in 68, in Paul VI's Humana Vitae, there was a quote in there about cautioning about having, quote, faith in technical expedience. And a second quote that said, some of these things will be hard for people to accept. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the church's teachings. Well, here we are. Yep. I mean, once again, the information from the papacy is prophetic. So, but my next point which is important, is when has the church not been countercultural? We start 2,000 years ago, it was a countercultural movement, and it still is. But the reason we're kind of that lonely voice, cautious voice, this IVF and similar techniques have been essentially normalized since the 80s. Mm-hmm. It has become, well, we can't have kids the regular way, so let's have kids from a technological perspective. And you've got, I think it was a Pew study shortly after the Alabama ruling, that 85% of Americans support IVF. Well, we saw politicians run for cover.
Right. You know, oh, absolutely.
Adamantly pro-life politicians that either at best stayed quiet, or most of them ran to vote to support IVF. And it's hard to counter, you know, the approximately 100,000 babies a year in that country, when they're probably about 8 million total since the 80s. And the point I bring up with the people that are truly and honestly anti-abortion, I mean, they are as pro-life as you can be, but they support these technologies. If they believe that a fertilized egg is a human, that's a human being, then why is IVF any different? Why should they be frozen? Why should they be disposed of? Why should they be sold for research purposes, things like that? And the justice in Alabama that wrote the majority opinion had I thought was the spot on point to make, that these are unborn children regardless of their location.
Right.
Whether in the womb or in a petri dish, this is a person deserving of respect, dignity, protection. And, you know, when you've got a million, I know Father Tad I heard him use this term some years ago, and it still just makes me queasy, these frozen orphanages. Estimates are there are a million frozen embryos in the country right now. And, you know, what's going to happen to them? Essentially, they become commodities. As I mentioned, they can be sold for research purposes. If the parents don't want to pay the fees for storage any longer, well, they're disposed of. So, and there is mounting evidence. There's some really good studies out of Australia that point to the negative impact with IVF conceived babies, low birth weight, increased prematurity risk, some birth defects and all. And now that we've got a few decades of this, we're starting to see some long-term follow-up that the risk of cardiovascular problems seems to be higher in these kids as well. And the point I want to make clear is it's not just like in everything else, it's not the baby's fault.
Right.
If that child is allowed to develop and grow and really flourish, that's wonderful. I mean, it is not the person, it is the process that is the concern with this. It's a hard sell, but but just because it's difficult to convince people doesn't mean that we don't try to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. As you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, I've done presentations and lectures on IVF as well. And it's really amazing that, you know, as you say, people who are very strongly pro-life, they support IVF, and they support it because, hey, you're bringing about life. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of that is out of ignorance as to what really happens in terms of, you know, how many embryos are destroyed versus, you know, what's the ratio between those destroyed versus those that, you know, come to birth. I've heard 7-1, 8-1, if not higher than that. And when people hear about it, I do a presentation every summer down at the Louisiana Right to Life. Shout out to Louisiana Right to Life, their Pulse conference for high school students. And I do an IVF presentation, and students just have no clue. And when they hear exactly what you're saying, you know, they're, you know, take away the, you know, you're manufacturing human beings outside of the marital act. So take that off the table, which is highly problematic in even in itself. But when you get into the, you know, the screening processes, you know, for sex, screening for genetic issues. And screening basically is a euphemism for destroy. You know, we're screening out, you know, a selective reduction. If, you know, you implant multiple embryos and then, you know, too many take, so to speak, we're going to selectively reduce, i.e. abort. And then, as you said, there's the ongoing research, emerging research on the effects of children of IVF. And, you know, when people hear that, at least they're starting to think. And I think just, you know, bringing the truth out is, you know, is really, really important. And that's what we need to keep doing.
Yeah. And I think one of the most troubling concepts to me, we know I was doing some online research recently, and there was a fertility center in New York State that had a sliding scale of, if depending upon the woman's age, how many embryos should be frozen. Mm-hmm. For women over 40, they recommended at least 70 should be frozen.
70 embryos or eggs are you talking?
Eggs. I should say eggs.
Okay. I was going to say.
Oh my goodness. Exactly. Now, but the other thing is this, you mentioned the selective, you know, reduction.
Right. But abortion.
Yeah. Basically abortion. You're doing a laboratory based abortion is what you're doing. And again, I believe this started from talking with Father Tad Boholchik about it, but it was like a microscopic beauty pageant. Well, we have eight embryos, and let's look at the ones that are the best looking, the ones that are the cells are more robust and they look better. Those are the ones we're going to go for. But, you know, we're seeing this shift towards, well, I want blue eyes, blonde hair.
Right.
I want a boy. I don't want a girl. And it is eugenics all over again. And it is a selfish and self-serving means of becoming a parent. And designer children are not what God intends for us to have.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to kind of follow up one other thing on this. It's really, I find it interesting that the Alabama State Supreme Court ruled what it did about embryonic life, that, you know, mm-hmm. these embryos are human beings. But that's not really the conversation. The conversation is not about that. The conversation is about, quote unquote, protecting access to IVF. And then the abortion supporters, you know, they're trying to change the subject as well. Because if under the law, these embryos, you know, are human beings, which they are, which we know they are, that absolutely impacts the abortion question as well, too. So it's not surprising that, you know, the shift away from the central question happen so quickly. But it's just really interesting that, you know, we don't, as a society, we don't want to address the question of what are these embryos, you know, what are, and they are human beings. And that's what the court said. But we don't want to talk about that.
Yeah. I think the Alabama decision was kind of the shock and awe moment certainly for politicians, but for a lot of people. But it is now the opportunity for that information to be out there and to be digested by people. And ultimately, if people think long and hard about this, particularly pro-life individuals that still support IVF, there's got to be that, hey, hold the phone moment. Something's not quite the way that I thought it was. And it should become self-evident, not as quickly as we'd like, of course, but soon enough.
Yeah, absolutely. This concludes part one of my conversation with Dr. Tim Millay. In part two, Tim discusses his and the Catholic Medical Association's efforts to combat chemical abortion, transgenderism, brain death, and assisted suicide. He also addresses the pressing need for conscience and religious liberty protections and calls for greater commitment to public advocacy. For more information on the topics discussed today and other bioethical issues, please visit our website, ncbcenter.org, where you can subscribe to our newsletter, as well as our publications, Ethics and Medics, and the National Catholic Bioethics Quarterly. The views expressed on Bioethics on Air are not necessarily those of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. If you have comments or questions about this or any of our podcasts, please contact me, your host, Joe Zalot, at jzalot@ncbcenter.org. Archived editions of the podcasts are available on our website, please hover on the blogs and podcasts button on the main page, and then click Bioethics on Air. Finally, if you enjoy our podcasts, please subscribe to them. And if you would like to support them, as well as the mission and ongoing work of the NCBC, go to our website, again, ncbcenter.org, and click on the red donate button. Thank you for listening, and may God's peace be with you.